You're listening to Green Left Radio, and on the line we have Dennis O'Neill. Dennis O'Neill is a retired postal worker. He is a revolutionary socialist, I think a member of an organisation called Liberation Road, and he's also involved in the labour branch of the Democratic Socialists of America in the United States. So, yeah, good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Jacob, and whoever else is there.
Hi, yes. Dennis, it's Megan.
Yeah. All right. So I guess the first question, Dennis, I'd like to ask you is, can you tell us, okay, about what's kind of happening around in the political situation in terms of in response to COVID-19 in the United States?
Well, all right. First, you've got to understand, let me just speak briefly, what the overall situation in the United States is. And the answer is, we don't know. We have no idea. As you probably know, the first big clump was in a retirement home in Washington, the state of Washington, which has spread and caused many deaths and so on in Washington. Right now, the state of Florida has 19 long care facilities for the elderly with COVID-19 cases. 19. The state has done a total of 2,800 tests for a population of 22 million people. So we have no idea who's affected, how affected they are, and so on. And we're going to find out in the next 2 weeks, probably, or get the first real idea of just how bad things are going to be. On the economic front, of course, like you, we're having a massive meltdown. And all three major car companies have closed their plants. The largest operator of shopping malls in the country has closed all 256 of their malls. So you have tremendous numbers of people who are off the job, being thrown out of work, and many of whom think, because of the way it's being reported, that they're going to go back in 2 weeks, that's just not going to happen. Maybe 2 months, but probably not. So enormous economic dislocation. And, of course, we've got a lying narcissist as a president. So
yeah, and
there it is.
What has been the kind of response from the kind of major parties, which is both the Democrats and the Republicans? What is sort of the proposals that they're kind of trying to put forward or measures to deal with this sort of crisis?
Well, it's very interesting. We have the tricameral situation, and the Supreme Court doesn't really enter into it at this point. Tripartite, I should say. So Congress and the president have been, largely setting the pace. At this point, the House of Representatives, the lower house of the Congress, which is in Democratic control, is essentially taking the lead. And they're doing sort of emergency stopgap stuff to try and stabilize the economy and try to put the government onto more of a war footing to deal with the virus. The devil, of course, is in the details. Trump himself, the first things that he wanted to rescue was the investment banks, which are in trouble, and the hospitality industry, notably cruise ship lines, but also hotels. So this is all, he is totally unreliable for anything. So what happens is bills get put through the House, mostly to pump a bunch of money into the economy and to try to get the government to put in the War Powers Act, which lets the government start industries, take over existing industries, repurpose them to produce what's needed, et cetera. And so that's kind of where things are at on that front. And of course, we have a two-party system, so that's what you've got. And bad as the Democrats are, and they definitely are a party of big capital, the Republicans are a nightmare.
Yeah. Dennis, I've got a couple of questions. Sorry about that technical issue just before.
Speak up a little bit, if you would.
Oh, absolutely. So, Dennis, I've got a couple of questions. So, firstly, you know, the US government has poured, I think it's $1.5 trillion into big business. And it seems that there isn't really much in the way of money to go directly to the workers. Is there any kind of program that that the government is rolling out to help workers, to for the money that they're putting into the economy to go directly to the workers? And there's also the issue, you know, I see it as a ticking time bomb in the US of the healthcare system. I mean, the piecemeal way that it is organized, but also the fact that, you know, that healthcare in America is so hard to access, but also so difficult to access financially because it's so expensive. Can you comment on both of those aspects of the pandemic in the US?
Certainly. There has been legislation passed essentially mandating that companies, and you know how this will be implemented and so on, early days yet, companies that are not using their employees, close facilities, furlough people, etc., have to continue to pay them for at least 2 weeks, and that's not going to be much, but it's a start. Similarly, unemployment insurance is being opened up wide, but that is a benefit that's paid state by state, and most of the unemployed insurance is underfunded. So the money for this is going to have to come from the government. And the third thing is that there are a couple of bills in the House that have been put in to give direct payments to every American. And the main one is for two payments of $1,000 each over the course of the next couple months. The Trump administration is counteroffering $1,000 with maybe $500 a child. In the meantime, however, there is a lot of this happens at the state level. Or through union negotiations, and we're not a very unionized country, but sorry, lost my train of thought there. Let me go on to your second question and I'll return. This healthcare situation is totally dire. It's largely privatized, and even the public, close quote, hospitals are not-for-profits, run by executives who draw huge salaries. The history of the United States over the last 30 years is the closing of more and more public hospitals. Today, they try to push people out as quickly as they can. You can get major surgery and go out of the hospital the same day or the next day. So there is very little capacity to take the influx that's coming. Also, even though they're unionized, there's no medical equipment for what we're facing, and even more important, there is no or very little called PPE, personal protective equipment, for medical personnel. As in Guangzhou, as in northern Italy, we are going to have a lot of doctors and nurses and aides and orderlies dying because they are going, and you know, this is going to start within the next couple of weeks because they are going to be swamped. They're going to be working to exhaustion and they are going to be working without it. Already, even though it's not well reported, there are clumps of cases around the U.S. In fire departments. We don't have a unified fire service. Every town, in some, you know, they have a public fire service in New York, but it's the New York Fire Department. In small towns, it's volunteer fire departments. And already you're getting clumps where somebody has been rescued, you know, taken to the hospital, and now firemen are testing positive.
The next question, I guess, is now you kind of really did a good kind of summary, I guess, of the kind of political situation in the United States and the particularities of that. You're a part of, and I forgot to sort of mention this in your introduction, you have been part of initiating this group, which is the People's Pandemic kind of response in the States. And
People's Coronavirus Response is the name.
Okay, yep, that's correct then. And what can you tell us, I guess, about the kind of grassroots kind of response, to the coronavirus, maybe starting with what trade unions are doing, especially since this whole thing shakes up, how the entire left can organize.
Absolutely. We don't know what's going to happen. And we also, one thing that we can be sure of in all of this, and fortunately, a lot of people are aware of this, thanks to the work of Naomi Klein and others and the experience of Katrina, we're looking at disaster capitalism coming our way, privatizations, this, that, and people are gearing up to fight it. In the unions, you have two kinds of things going on. One is at the top levels in the unions, people are negotiating to make sure that union members get all the negotiated benefits that they have and to get those extended. For example, in my union, the American Postal Workers Union, we want limits on the amount of mandatory overtime people have to serve, on the ability to take, we've already won the ability for people to take sick leave without getting three doctor's notes and the kind of bullshit that they normally make people put up with to do it. So the unions are, to some extent, stepping forward on that. The better unions are doing a lot. One of the first to really raise this and take it up was the National Nurses Union, who held a press conference alerting people to the very poor condition, the poor condition that the healthcare system is in to respond. Other unions are, there are four major postal unions along craft lines, and I just got contacted yesterday by somebody who's in touch with about 20,000 postal workers on various groups and stuff. We're hoping to organize a conference call to figure out what to fight for and how to deal with it. And those questions can be tricky. I mean, I personally, if you were going to take a strictly trade union view of it, you would say, close the postal service down until it's safe for a couple of months. If you want to regard the U.S. Postal Service as a part of the commons, we are not privatized. We are the quasi-governmental or governmental agency most liked by the American people, 80% positive ratings in the polls, and we're a target for privatization. So I think we want to keep going on some level as long as we can, but we have to talk among ourselves and figure out how to balance those things out and what demands to put forward. So that's kind of it on the union front. There have been, strikes, walkouts with people, small ones, semi-wildcats, with people demanding protective equipment, demanding that policies be changed and so on. And there's going to be a lot more of that.
Yeah. The other thing I'm interested in knowing about, I guess, in terms of the grassroots response is in Australia, and I also know in the UK, there has also been a lot of kind of through the grassroots, a kind of mutual aid kind of networks kind of organizing. And I imagine in the United States, you probably need that kind of work done even more, and like to hear about what kind of work has been done there.
Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yep.
Shit. Just a second.
Oh, yeah, we can hear you. We can hear you.
Okay, good.
Yeah, yep.
All right, I can hear you again now. Yes, the original outpouring and the thing that, I mean, this thing that the People's Coronavirus Network that People's Coronavirus Response is what we call it. Since people don't do blogs anymore, we're essentially trying to build it on Facebook, which involves a lot of jury rigging of Facebook, but to concentrate stuff. It has gone from 2 people to 10,000 in a week. And most of the early responses were exactly around how do we develop mutual aid? How do we develop community response methods? And that takes very different forms. You know, some people are extremely concerned about the elderly in their communities. People are concerned about, were concerned and still are about schools being kept open when kids have huge exposure, and even though their rate of serious illness is much lower, you know, a classroom, if you'll remember your second year in elementary school, is a hotbed of exchanging, you know, dirt, bodily fluids, whatever you've got. And so, those were the kind of things. There's another trend within it, which is sort of more forward-looking. People with backgrounds, some in anarchism, some in Occupy, some in the more organized left forms, are trying to figure out how to build mutual aid that can be sustainable, not just people going, oh my God, we've collected a lot of money, how do we get groceries to old people, which is a very good thing and we support, but we want to integrate that into how do we build organization that can do this in an efficient way, especially in those many, many places where the government simply is not doing it, and demonstrate that there's a better way to organize the world while we're doing this.
I guess the next kind of aspect is how has kind of COVID-19 impacted, I guess, on the existing campaigning that has happened in the United States? And I guess the two issues that I'm interested in hearing comment on, which actually intersect in some ways, is the question of immigrant rights and prisoner rights.
Okay, let me take the prisoner rights first, because that's the, in a certain way, the easiest and the most obvious. The prisoner rights movement, including the new abolition forces, more reform-minded forces, and so on, have jumped into this very actively because they immediately perceived that prisoners were going to be at enormous risk. Indeed they are. So people are putting demands very strongly on the government to release prisoners. Some states have essentially passed policies stating that no long trials will be held during the course of this. You know, getting the same group of people into the same room day after day after day pretty much guarantees that they will all get COVID-19. So that is a fairly fierce struggle, and there are some progressive politicians and representatives who are pushing very hard on it. Others in an election year are shying away a little, but we are making a lot of noise, and I think that people's attention has been caught, for example, by Brazil, where there have been prisoner rebellions, where they've taken over the prisons and then busted out. And something like that would not necessarily be unlikely in many of America's privatized prisons. They are understaffed, the staff is not trained, and the staff is worried that they're going to get COVID-19 too, and they don't think anybody has their backs. So you could get large-scale breakouts. We'll have to see. I'm not predicting it, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me. Immigrants' rights is an extremely difficult or not extremely difficult. It's an obvious question. Let the damn people out. They haven't done anything. We've got people in camps. We've got children in camps. Deal with it later. And the demand has been put forward. I am not, and people have spoken on it, including political figures and stuff, I am not aware of any legislation on that. And unlike most of the prison stuff, which is on a state basis where you can actually win it, the Immigration Service is federal, and hating immigrants is a substantial portion of Trump's appeal to his reactionary base. So I'm not sure how we're going to be able to bust that loose, but it's a demand that's being raised again and again.
This is another question I'm sort of just interested in just exploring. We've got to probably wrap this up soon. But I guess going back to the question around Donald Trump, I kind of want to hear about a bit of your commentary on, you know, one of the things I've noticed is that he's trying to push this really kind of strongly kind of xenophobic angle in response to the virus. That is the question around the question of China. In fact, he refers it constantly as the China virus. And then there has been, I also remember during the Democratic debate, there was a question posed to Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders that, you know, raised that should China be paying or suffer consequences for COVID-19? And yeah, I want to hear a bit of your comments on that.
Well, that's a big real problem. Let me make a final point when it's time to go. I just want to say one last thing. But on this, the biggest problem now is that this, you know, China flu and insisting on it in the face of criticism and so on is a pitch to the base. And it has already resulted in an increase of violence against Asian Americans. And Americans are not particularly discerning about this. So it's anybody who looks Chinese to them is being blamed for this, et cetera. I think that we're going to face more of this. You know, the left, the churches, everyone is speaking out on this and calling it out as racism, which is what it is. But, Trump has daily press conferences now at which the main thing he says is China virus. So that is a major problem. The larger question of the collapse of, you know, the global system of exchange, payments, the whole economic system is now being challenged, not just by this, but also by the Saudi-Russian war over oil prices, which I'm not going to get into, but that's feeding the economic difficulties that we're looking at. So that is a major problem for us and one that we continually address.
All right. So, Dennis, I'd like to kind of wrap it up now, but I guess do you have any kind of final kind of comments you like to kind of make on sort of anything you've spoken about?
Yeah, I do. The biggest problem, and, you know, we are at the very start of what's obviously going to be a steep learning curve. Those of us who are trade unionists, who are of the left, who are experienced in organizations, who go back decades in the struggle, all the stuff we know how to do involves face-to-face stuff, involves people in groups, preferably large groups, preferably closely proximate to each other, whether it's Occupy, whether it's picket lines, whether it's mass protests. And we are having to learn very quickly how to mobilize in a situation where to do that would be criminally irresponsible because it would promote the rapid spread of the virus and hence the collapse of the medical system and so on. So everything that we're doing is early days yet, and we're trying to figure it out. But if you guys come up with anything, do please let me know.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Dennis.
Thank you, Dennis.
It's been a pleasure having you on the program.
Well, thank you for having me. And international solidarity is as important as domestic solidarity. So let us keep this up.
Absolutely. True words. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.